You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein here on this beautiful Thursday afternoon for Leonard Lopate. Each of us is faced with hundreds of decisions. Sometimes it feels like millions of decisions each day. From the relatively small, what ringtone should I use for my phone today? To the major, should we refinance our mortgage? Should I have that heart operation? Each time, we have to make a choice, whether or not we're well-informed about the issue or the opportunity. And our environment may influence us. If the doctor says 90% of the people who have this operation are alive in 10 years, we may make a different decision than if she says 10 out of 100 people who have this operation are dead within 10 years. University of Chicago professors Richard H. Thaler and Cass R. Sunstein have written a book to help us make better choices. It's called Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. The book is published by Yale University Press, and I'm pleased that it brings Richard Thaler to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
So I noticed the first thing when I looked at the cover, I noticed you've chosen a one-word title for a book like this. Are you following in the footsteps of things like Blink?
Well, we certainly hope to follow in the footsteps of Blink in terms of how many books we sell. But, you know, we've read our own book.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, and we even wrote the book. And we try to practice what we preach. So we try to nudge people to buy the book. And having a one-word title that really captures the essence of the idea, we thought was a nice idea. And then, as you know, we have on the cover of the book a picture of a mother elephant.
Yes.
Nudging her baby, her somewhat resisting baby elephant forward. And we thought that image, most authors don't get involved with the cover. We got involved with everything. And
so did you say, I think we want an elephant on the cover
of
this book?
Well, we searched for images of nudges, and this one just popped out at us as being exactly, you know, it's about maternalism. And that's one of the themes of the book. So,
well, you know, as I read the book, there are a lot of different phrases, and nudge was the first one that you get, and which is not a phrase, it's a word, but you make it very clear within the first couple of pages that it's nudge, not nudge. Can you
Correct.
Talk about the difference there for you?
Right. Well, this is a very important difference distinction to make in New York. And the title of our book is Nudge Rhymes with Judge, not nudge. And a nudge is somebody who pesters you. And a nudge is a gentle poke that steers you in a certain direction. And in fact, we are all about nudging without being nudges.
Now, when I introduced this, I introduced it about choices. That really is the heart of your book, is the opportunity to have choices, but as you also explained, the kind of bewilderment sometimes we have when we face choices. What does the nudge do to help us with that?
Well, so the way we use the word nudge in the book is it's really any small feature of the environment that influences our choices. And what research in psychology shows is that, first of all, we're very busy. You don't need a psychologist to tell you that. But we know that even the tiniest of features in the environment can influence what we do. One of my favorite examples from the book comes from, of all places, the Amsterdam airport. And there, an economist of all people was trying to think of a way to get men to pay a little more attention when they were using the men's room. And he adopted the following brilliant strategy. In each of the urinals, he had etched into the urinal the image of a black housefly. And this image was placed a few inches away from the drain. And it really looks real. I went to Amsterdam to investigate this story.
That was an important bit of research
do. It was there. And so men get up there, and, you know, when men are doing their business, they're usually thinking about something else. And but all of a sudden they see this house fly, and if you give a man something to aim at, he aims.
Well, as the mother of two boys, I read that part and thought, I think we need an etching of a housefly in our house.
Absolutely. And in fact, it's here's a business opportunity for Toto or one of the toilet makers to add a little housefly to every toilet.
Yes, to be able to do that.
So the housefly in this example is a perfect illustration of a nudge. And it's an example of the sort of thing that economic theory would say is irrelevant. So, you know, why should people's behavior be influenced by a fake housefly? And the answer is that we're not always paying attention to what we do. If we can attract someone's attention, then we can influence the choices that they make.
It's like cueing. It's giving you a little bit of a cue towards what kind of behavior you're...
Exactly. And, you know, there are studies that the music that is playing influences the food that people eat. You put on Italian music, people go for the pasta. You know, if you put on, I don't know whether Japanese music would send you toward the sushi, but that's the idea.
I'm speaking with Richard Thaler. He teaches at the University of Chicago, and with another professor there, Cass Sunstein. He has written a book called Nudge from Yale University Press. Now, how might the image of the housefly in the urinal is a very concrete one. How might this work in other situations? How might we employ this kind of a nudge in our daily lives?
Well, let's take, since we've been talking about food and it's lunchtime, one of the examples we use to motivate the book is suppose that there's some cafeteria director of, say, a school district, maybe the New York City school district, with thousands of cafeterias all over the city and hundreds of thousands of kids eating at those cafeterias. And what she discovers is that the order in which she displays the food influences the food that the kids eat. And we ask, well, what use should she make of that information?
So that if you put, say, the French fries first versus the carrots first, people will make different choices.
Exactly. So she might decide, well, you know, we'd rather have people eat carrots than French fries, so let's put the carrots in front of the French fries. Or maybe put the French fries a little bit harder to reach. In the cafeteria I eat in every day at the University of Chicago Business School, the first thing one comes to is the salad bar. And you have to walk past the salad bar to get to the burgers and fries. That's good. So notice the person who designed where each food item goes is what we call in our book a choice architect. And so anybody who designs the environment in which you make a choice is a choice architect. If you go into a restaurant, there's a menu. Somebody decided the order to put the items. Somebody in some restaurants, it's trendy now to have one of the words in each item be in bold. And it almost looks like they pick a word at random. It could be the chicken, it could be the mole. I don't know how they decide. But it's a good bet that it matters whether they put the mole in bold or the chicken in bold.
Just as it matters in this cafeteria whether the salad bar is first or the desserts are first.
So the first point of this cafeteria example is that choice architects, and we are all choice architects in our own little domains. You're a parent, so you're a choice architect for your kids. I'm a teacher. I'm a choice architect for my students. And the person writing the menu is a choice architect. So let's get back to our friend, the cafeteria director. What should she do with that information? Well,
knowing that she can influence behavior by the way that she sets things
up. Right, and she can influence behavior without mandating and without restricting. So many people have said, look, we should take unhealthy foods out. And there may be an argument for that. But we resist those sorts of things in our book. And what we ask is, what can we do to improve behavior simply by nudging? So we say, well, one thing she might do is arrange the food in an order that will tend to make the kids, to induce the kids to eat healthier foods. And now that she could also try to fatten the kids up. Maybe her kids are overweight and she'd like them to have less of a disadvantage, so fatten up all the other kids. Or maybe she should feature the food that she gets the biggest bribes from her suppliers. It's possible to do evil nudging and good nudging. There are two important points from this example. One is that you can't avoid nudging. There's no
such... You can unconsciously nudge or you can consciously nudge.
Well, and there's no such thing as a neutral environment. So the food has to be somewhere. You either have the salad bar first or second. It's like a real building has a real architecture, and that architecture will influence choices. So the first point is that you have to pick some arrangement. And the second point is that you can pick an arrangement that will help people, and we say, why not do it?
You also have a third piece here in that you emphasize quite strongly that you don't want to limit choices. You want to be able to have the choices available, say, in the cafeteria, that French fries, you argue, should be there. It's just we can make a decision about how we help people make these choices.
Well, that's right. I mean, we don't take a view about whether French fries should or shouldn't be in the school cafeteria. But the view we take is that we're trying for a sort of new middle ground here politically. So there are people who, let's call them do-gooders, who would make a very short list of things that kids should be allowed to eat, possibly mainly carrots and tofu, and limit them to that. Then there would be the pure libertarians, let the kids eat anything they want. And we're trying to strike a middle ground where we say, okay, we're not going to ban French fries, but we're going to encourage people to eat more carrots. And that's the approach we take to everything we talk about in the book. We use the kind of clunky phrase libertarian paternalism to describe our philosophy. Our book publisher cringes every time I use the phrase.
And you acknowledge in the book that you're taking two rather discredited or terms that people are a little bit uncomfortable with and putting them together to create something new.
We've been assured that had the title been libertarian paternalism instead of nudge, that even our mothers would have blanched at buying the book. But our argument is that actually both words are unobjectionable, even lovable, at least the way we define them. So by libertarian, all we mean is choice preserving. So we try to design environments where people are free to choose. That's all we mean by libertarian. By paternalistic, we don't mean telling people what to do. That would violate the libertarian part. But we mean caring about the outcome. So just like a mother cares whether her kids grow up healthy, wealthy, and wise, so I think we all feel that we should give every citizen the best shot at living a healthy, wealthy life. And so why not devise institutions that make it more likely that we humans stumble toward good decisions rather than bad decisions?
I'm speaking with the behavioral economist Richard Thaler. He's author of the new book, Nudge, which is published by Yale University Press. We have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. This is the Leonard LoPage Show. I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard today, and I'm speaking with Richard Thaler, author of the new book Nudge, which is published by Yale University Press. And we were just talking about the phrase you've put together, libertarian paternalism. And I know as I read the book, I thought, would it have been different if it was libertarian maternalism, that we have different associations, perhaps, with those two different words?
Well, perhaps. And we've certainly been encouraged by some that we should adopt that phrase. But we thought the phrase was confusing enough. without trying to suggest how maternalism might differ from paternalism. So we figured enough is enough.
You co-wrote this book with Cass Sunstein. You're a behavioral economist. He's a lawyer and teaches law. How did you have to nudge each other in terms of getting the book written?
Well, Cass is a very prolific author. And I don't know how many books he's written, maybe 20. He tends to be very fast. I tend to be slow. That's probably a good combination. So he's very good at getting a first draft out. I sometimes get writer's block. So we complement each other in that way. The other thing that we did, since we have different backgrounds, we found different parts of the book hard. So there's a section of the book about money. And Cass always says, oh, these chapters on money are so hard. And, you know, they weren't hard for me. So I would work very hard to make them accessible to him. And then he's an expert on the environment. And we have a chapter on marriage. He's an expert on that. And so, again, I would say, well, you know, you're talking about all these regulations and I don't understand what they are. So we had two rules. We each had to be able to understand everything in each chapter in addition to each chapter was passed through each of our word processors 20 or 30 times. But we also had a rule that if either of us found something boring, we kicked it out.
That's a good rule.
So it had to be interesting to both of us.
Did you ever have fights about that piece of it?
We don't fight. We're very good friends. We've been friends for years. And I'm happy to say we've gotten to be better friends during the process. It's like a married couple building a house. The divorce rate is about a third for that. And I think friends writing a book is probably the same. But no, I think we each had chapters that were left on the cutting room floor. And, you know, we each think that the ones we wrote the first draft of were pretty good, but it didn't pass the boring test. So they're there. Maybe they'll resurface in our next book, which we've tentatively titled Fudge or Smudge or something like that.
You do tackle subjects, though, that not only frighten people sometimes, but are very complicated, like money, which you talked, and I'm glad you're here because I can talk to you about that chapter. In that chapter, you talk about the choices that we make or the fact that sometimes we choose not to make choices in things like our 401ks or our mortgage choices, which is big in the news right now. How can nudges help us with those difficult decisions?
Well, one thing is that in both of those domains, the world has gotten a lot more complicated in the last 20 years. In most 401k plans, they're not an old institution. They started about 20 years ago. There used to be half a dozen options in a typical plan. And it was relatively easy to choose. Now a plan can have 50 funds. And many people are just bewildered by that. And in fact, research has shown that the more funds there are in the plan, the longer it takes for people to sign up because they suffer from choice overload. And they go, oh, my God, I don't know what to do. So they don't do anything.
So I'm not going to do anything.
Right.
Yes, I can relate to that.
And mortgages also have gotten more complicated. It used to be 25 years ago that pretty much everybody got a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. They put 20% down, and that was that. And choosing a mortgage was finding the best 30-year mortgage that had the lowest interest rate. There was only one dimension, really, to care about. Now there's all these different mortgages, variable rates, and they're pegged to different things, and prepayment penalties, and balloons, and blah, blah, blah. And, oh, my God, most economists don't feel that they really understand enough.
And most investment bankers didn't understand enough either.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we've got these very complicated worlds that are getting more complicated by the day. How can we help? Well, let's do the 401k first. The first and simplest step is to get people enrolled. It's almost always a good idea to join your 401k plan. And if your employer offers a match, it's certainly a good idea. If you don't join, you're just turning down free money. And yet, it depends on the company, but as many as 40% of new employees don't join the plan immediately, and many take as long as 3 years to get around to filling out those forms. So the simplest step you can take to encourage enrollment is what's called automatic enrollment. Now, in a typical plan, the way it works is when you're first eligible for the plan, you get a big package of forms to fill out, and they say, choose your investment options, choose your saving rate, fill these in, send them back, and you join. And many of us, both Cass and I are formophobic. This is a disease that particularly strikes professors. And we hate filling out forms, so we're particularly sensitive to this. And so under automatic enrollment, on that same day when you're first eligible, you get all those forms, but you also get a note that says, if you do nothing, we're enrolling you. And we're enrolling you at this saving rate and in this fund. And you're free to make other selections, but if you do nothing, that's what happens. This is what we call a default option. The default option is what happens if you do nothing.
Which these days, the default option is nothing happens if you
exactly.
do nothing.
And again, going, it's just like in the cafeteria example, the first thing to notice is somebody has to decide what the default is. Should it be that nothing happens, or should it be that something happens? The choice architect is the one who makes that decision. And we think, since you have to pick one of those, why not pick the one that will benefit 95% of the people?
And you could still say, all right, my choice is to do nothing, so don't enroll me. So people are still allowed their choices of saying, then you have to actively opt out, in
exactly.
a sense, rather than passively opt out.
Exactly. So the other thing that we urge people to do is, along with a colleague of mine called Shlomo Benarzi at UCLA, he and I have devised something that we call Save More Tomorrow. And the idea of Save More Tomorrow is most participants in 401k plans say they think they should be saving more. Something like two-thirds of the people say, yes, I should be saving more. But it's like many of us think we should weigh a little less or exercise a little more. But they somehow never get around to it. Many of us are planning diets in a month or two. So we give them the chance to save more tomorrow. And the way we do that is we write to them and say, we notice you're not saving very much. Would you like to join the Save More Tomorrow plan? Under this, you can commit yourselves now to increasing your saving rates every time you get a raise. And in companies that have adopted this, many employees have signed up, and some have tripled their saving rates in a very quick period of time. This plan is now offered in thousands of companies in America and is slowly spreading around the world. And it's really a perfect example of a nudge, because all we're doing is giving people an opportunity to commit themselves to doing something they want to do. We're not making anybody do anything.
I'm speaking with Richard Thaler, who teaches at the University of Chicago, and he is the co-author of a new book called Nudge, which is from Yale University Press. So there you've talked about the 401k in terms of mortgages. And as you say, the decision making has become much more complex. What kinds of thoughts did you have there?
Well, we think that the modern world requires modern technology to deal with the problems. So we've devised a plan that we have an acronym RECAP. I won't go through what it stands for. But here's the basic idea as applied to mortgages. When you apply for a mortgage, the current rules now is you are required to have disclosure. They have to give you all kinds of information, which is 30 pages of unintelligible prose.
That you're given the day you're about to sign it, or maybe a couple of days before, but yes, it's
right.
Rare to get through.
And no one reads it. It's safe to say no one reads it. To a first approximation, no one on earth has ever read those things. So what do we propose? We propose that the lender would be required to, before you take the mortgage, also send you an email with an electronic file. It would be like a spreadsheet. And the file would have all of that fine print embedded in the file in formulas. Now, you might be thinking, oh, great. What do I do with that? The answer would be that we're sure that if mortgage lenders were required to provide that, there would be immediately websites that would pop up that would interpret those. So you'd upload that file with one click. You'd go to mortgagehelper.com or some such thing. You'd upload the file, and then they would translate it for you. And it would say, well, you do realize that although your initial payments are $1,400 a month, they would jump to $2,100 a month a year from now, even if interest rates don't change. And did you notice that if you prepay, there will be a $7,000 fee, and that your payments could go as high as $3,600 a month? And by the way, from our database, you seem to be eligible for the following other three mortgages, and they have the following features, and so forth and so on. We call this simplified transparency. And we think the exact same thing could be used for cell phone plans, for all kinds of Medicare prescription drugs. The prescription drug program we hold up as probably the worst bit of choice architecture we've discovered.
Well, it's interesting we're talking about mortgages and you're talking about Medicare, and being somewhat cynical, sometimes I look at these and say, I think it's intentional that these are very confusing.
Well, you know, it could be in the mortgage case that the lenders find it in their best interest to be opaque. That may be the way the market works. And what we like markets. We can't help it. We're from the University of Chicago, so we like markets. But we want markets to work better, and we think the way markets work best is if you have smart consumers. And we can't turn all consumers into PhDs in finance. So the best way to do that is to make it simpler for them to act as if they had PhDs in economics.
Or have access to someone who has a PhD in finance, whether it's through the internet, to then be able to say, oh, that's what this means.
Exactly. So now, there could be intentional opaqueness in the mortgage market. It's hard to believe that the designers of the new Medicare prescription drug program were intentionally making the program as opaque as possible. Though, actually, once you look at it, that becomes a plausible hypothesis.
Because it was so incredibly opaque that I had to wrestle with it a little bit with my mom, and it was just, I gave up.
Right. So this is, I can tell you the following story. So when we were writing the chapter on the prescription drug program, a friend of mine is an expert on this. And she, like many people our age, is dealing with her mother's prescription drugs, just like you were. And so she sent me the list of drugs that her mother takes. And she had spent 4 hours figuring out which plan her mother should take and said, go ahead, you try it. So I log on to the Medicare website and start typing in these drugs. The first thing you notice is there's no spell checker. Now, you know, drug names are like sequences of random letters. And so if the world, if you ever needed the Google did you mean software,
you need
this,
it here.
You need it there.
Yeah.
It's not there. And so, and if you type Xanax with a Z instead of an X, it just doesn't know what you're talking about. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that they actually know the drugs you take. There's no reason for that. After the first year of the program, they know the list.
Right, and everyone's insurance company knows whatever list it is that they
right.
have.
So again, we suggest exactly the same plan for prescription drugs as for mortgages and credit cards and cell phones.
So that there's more understanding and clarity and people can find things out rather than right. spend hours.
Right, so
wrestling.
Here's the way it would work. And your mother would get an email, i.e. you would get an email, that from the government or from your insurance provider, one of the 50 you have to choose from in New York, and it would have you'd get two files. The first would be a list of all the prices they charge for every drug. The second would be a list of all the drugs you take. Now, a fact of life is the older you get,
the more
drugs you take. And most of them are permanent. You know, you add one per year, something like that. And so the drugs that a 75-year-old takes is very easily predictable from the drugs they took last year. So it's quite easy to predict which would be the best policy based on what they had last year. The government could do that. The state of Maine actually is doing it, but most states aren't doing it, and the federal government is discouraging it.
Well, there are stories about this and many other things in the new book, Nudge, that you have written with Cass Sunstein. Richard Thaler, thank you so much for joining me here in the Leonard Lopate Show today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.